Welcome to Simple Living Works, episodes 84 and 85. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, renowned biblical scholar Walter Brueggemann, talking about his recent book, Money and Possessions. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue. Walter Brueggemann was my guest in 2016, talking about his short devotional book, Sabbath, Resistance to the Culture of Now. His recent scholarly book examines money and possessions throughout the entire Bible. Episode 1 of this two-part series presents his 6 theses about money and possessions in the Bible, observing their contradictory nature to the conventional wisdom and practice of both the ancient world and today's society. Episode 2 is a brief survey of the theme of money and possessions throughout the Bible. Of course, Walter makes some connections between the 6 theses and contemporary politics. The contents, preface, foreword, and introduction, including the 6 theses, are available for free online. The entire 300-page book is fascinating. Those items are essential reading. The link is in the show notes, as is a link to Walter's intriguing biography. The book is, of course, available for purchase at your local independent bookstore and also through interlibrary loan. Walter has been associated with Simple Living Works since it was known as Alternatives. He wrote the biblical reflections for the very first edition of our signature piece, Whose Birthday Is It Anyway?, in 1988. That's our Advent Christmas annual for families, individuals, and congregations. Since then, he has served on Alternatives' Honorary Board of Directors and on the selection committee for our collection of new hymns called Sing Justice, Do Justice, for which he wrote the foreword.
I'm so pleased to talk to Walter Brueggemann about his new book, Money and Possessions, part of the Interpretation Series from Westminster John Knox Press. And I hope that you will read at least the introduction, foreword, and preface, which you can see online, and there is a link in the show notes for this episode. We're going to briefly go through the whole Bible in this second episode, and I hope you will listen to the first episode as well. It includes the 6 theses that Walter puts forth in this book. So, briefly, the Torah, or the Pentateuch, is what we call Israel's core narrative. And you subtitled this chapter, No Coveting.
Right. I have a hard time figuring out how to enter this topic in the Bible because there's so much material. And what I decided to do was to focus on the word covet, which means wanting to possess what belongs to someone else. And the word occurs in 2 important places. It occurs in the 10th of the 10 commandments, thou shalt not covet. But the other interesting place that it occurs is in Genesis 3, with the man and the woman in the Garden of Eden. It says that they desired the forbidden fruit, and the word desired in Hebrew is the same word as the word covet. That is, they wanted what did not belong to them. And so I began my reflection for the book on the power of desire that leads us to take risks and to violate neighbors, or in the case of Genesis 3, to violate the rules of the garden. And as all of us know about either money or about sexuality, we get propelled by desire to do crazy, destructive, irresponsible things toward each other and toward ourselves. So I really wanted to suggest that the opening presentation of Israel's ancient Torah in the books of Moses maybe could be understood as a reflection on the propelling power of desire. And then I remembered Augustine's famous phrase, the great church theologian, that God is our true desire and our hearts are restless until they rest in God. And much of our desire, which is fed by the advertising liturgies of television, are false desires that are created to keep the consumer economy going. So we are recruited to desire another beer or another deodorant or another car or another computer or another or another or another, under the illusion that if we get another one of those things, somehow we'll be happier and safer and better. And it's all an illusion. So the false desires that tend to propel us are in deep contradiction to the true desire for life with God and life with neighbor. So that's how I sort of plunged into it. And then still in the Torah, I tried to feature Pharaoh in the Exodus story as the champion of desire because he thought that he would never have enough of land or of food or of slaves or anything. He always wanted more. And it turns out then that he becomes the enemy of God and the enemy of people that should have been his neighbors. I think the rest of the Bible then is a commentary on the Exodus narrative.
Moving on to Deuteronomy, you call this the great either-or of neighborliness.
That's right. In the book of Deuteronomy, Moses says, choose life or choose death, or theologically, choose Yahweh, the God of the covenant, or choose Baal, the God of commodity. And then if you track through the specific commandments of the book of Deuteronomy, most church people do not know, but there are all kinds of commandments about how to organize the economy for the sake of neighborliness. The most important of those commandments is what is called the year of release, which is the provision that at the end of 6 years, you have to forgive debts on poor people, because Moses did not want Israel to have a permanent underclass, and the only way you can prevent that is to simply cancel debts. And the urgency of the book of Deuteronomy is that Israel is being called to decide that it will either practice a neighborly economy or it will follow the people that Moses called the Canaanites. These were people who weren't signed on to the covenant, in which in that economy it's every person for himself or herself. And the book of Deuteronomy states with great urgency choosing life, which in Deuteronomy means life lived responsibly for the sake of the neighborhood. Do not choose death, which is to choose alienation and isolation and hostility. And I think that the urgency of that either-or continues in contemporary life, and I think our society now is making up its mind about a neighborly economy or an economy of greedy hostility. So the book of Deuteronomy contains expansive resources that the church really hasn't tapped into at all because we have not wanted to know about the either-or that is definitional for gospel faith.
Now, in the six historical books of Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, and 1 and 2 Kings, you subtitle that The Contest.
Yeah, the way I set it up, and obviously that's very complex material, so I had to make some decisions about how to be able to comment on it at all, but it's the same contest as the either-or of Pharaoh and Yahweh or in Deuteronomy. And what I argued is that King Solomon in the book of Kings represents the predatory economy of greed. It's too bad that we have this romantic notion of Solomon as the wise temple builder, because in fact what he was an aggressive covenanter who ended up with all the gold, and his lavish temple in Jerusalem is simply an exhibit, like modern football stadiums, of the wealth of those who have made it big. And so I argued that the monarchy of David and Solomon that runs for 400 years is exactly an institution that is predatory in its economic policies of taxation, and that the other side of the contest is basically held up by the prophetic tradition. The prophetic tradition would include early on Samuel and Nathan, who are present in the books of Samuel, but then it includes the great prophets of the 8th century of Isaiah, Micah, Hosea, Amos, and of the 7th century of Jeremiah and Zephaniah. Those are the principal ones, though there are many others. And they keep up an endless protest against royal predation, and they keep reminding the moneyed peoples in Jerusalem and in Samaria in the north before the north fell that they have an obligation to administer their wealth and their power for the sake of the vulnerable. And in both in Deuteronomy and in the prophets, the vulnerable are regularly listed as the widow, the orphan, the immigrant, and the poor. This is someone has called this the quadrilateral of the vulnerable: the widow, orphan, immigrant, and poor. And the widow and the orphan are vulnerable in a patriarchal society because you are lost if you don't have a male advocate, if you don't have a husband or a father. And immigrants, as we know, are people with no rights and very often with no advocates, and the poor are the left behind. So that the prophetic insistence is that the economy must take into account the legitimate needs of these people. And what the prophetic tradition then argues against all of the extravagance of the royal establishment, that if you do not care for the quadrilateral of the vulnerable, your kingdom is going to cease. And of course, as the Bible is put together, that's what happened. Jerusalem, the king, and the temple, and all of that was destroyed, which makes the argument that no amount of technology, no amount of finance, no amount of military power can sustain a society over time if it is not devoted to the common welfare of the vulnerable neighbors. And that's the contest. The contest in ancient Israel was whether the privileged elite who lived in Jerusalem around the king, whether their money and their smarts and their military power could sustain them while they neglected the vulnerable, or whether the disregard of the vulnerable would eventually lead to disaster. And the way the Bible puts it together, the outcome is quite clear, and the inference that I intended to communicate was that now is the same contest in our society. Whether the huge concentrations of wealth can continue the practice of privatization, which means the exclusion of the vulnerable from the economic abundance of our economy. It isn't hard to make a case, I think, that as in the ancient world, in the contemporary world, the assumption that you can live without reference to the vulnerable neighbor is a very self-destructive illusion, and it is very present in our society.
Well, briefly, I'd like to just mention some of the other themes in the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament. In chapter 5, you call 1st and 2nd Chronicles, Ezra and Nehemiah, empire and extraction, and you talk about how in the Persian period that the wealthy and powerful among the Israelites are partnered up with the empire to extract more from the poor people.
And that's the way every empire works. It doesn't do the dirty work itself, but it finds cooperative locals who will do the work. And what the Jewish tax collectors did was to tax poor Jews and send the money off to Persia and then keep some for themselves. And that, of course, is exactly the situation that Jesus found. The reason he pays attention to tax collectors is that they were Jews who had signed on with the Roman Empire to tax other Jews to send money off to Rome and then to keep some for themselves. And in the book of Nehemiah, which is not a book we read much, Nehemiah, who is the governor and some ways a tool of the Persian Empire, intervenes in Nehemiah 5 because he discovers that the powerful Jews are taxing the vulnerable Jews in order to get along with the Persian Empire, and he intervenes to put a stop to that practice. So it's not a big item in the whole Bible, but what you can see is that the Persian Empire was an extractor of wealth from the Jewish colony of Judah. What's so interesting about Nehemiah 5 is that it is a very concrete narrative that showed how these large systemic forces were operative in the lives of quite specific people. And I think that's the way empires work, including the U.S. empire.
Well, we'll move on to the New Testament or the Christian scriptures in just a second, but I do want to mention that there's a chapter on the Psalms and then on one on the Proverbs and Job, which is called Wise Beyond Smart, which shows how wisdom is more important than money smarts. Then the chapter on the prophets, which you've already touched on, which is called Wealth Ill-Gotten and Lost and Wealth Given Again. And then an interesting chapter on the five scrolls, which are the Book of Ruth, Song of Songs, Ecclesiastes, Lamentations, and Esther. Now, moving into the Gospels in the New Testament, you talk about all four at once, and you entitle that chapter Performance of an Alternative Economy.
Well, there was so much material in the Synoptic Gospels on Jesus and money that I had a really hard time deciding what to do about that. But some of it had to do with his parables. I've mentioned the parable of the man who tore down his barns and built bigger barns. And what struck me finally in both Matthew 6 and I think it's Luke 16, that Jesus' verdict is that you cannot serve God and mammon. We leave that word untranslated because it's too hard. It probably ought to be translated God and wealth or God and capital. But it is really the either-or of Moses or the contest of the prophets, which Jesus reperforms and reiterates. And I came to the conclusion, I'm not a New Testament scholar, so, you know, for what it's worth, I came to the conclusion that Jesus' use of the phrase kingdom of God really means an alternative economy of neighborliness. And then I tried to illustrate that, but as you know, at the beginning of Mark, Jesus' initial proclamation is, repent, for the kingdom of God is at hand, which I think in the Gospel of Mark means quit adhering to the kingdom of Rome, which is a predatory economy, and get ready to follow me into an alternative economy of generous sharing that shuns greed. And I tried to carry that out in a variety of textual forays. I suppose two of the best known examples are Mary's Magnificat in Luke 1, that is properly sung around Advent and Christmas, in which Mary sings that when Jesus gets started with his ministry, God will fill the hungry with good things and send the rich empty away. She is singing about an economic revolution that pretty much the Gospel of Luke carries through. And the other text that is so familiar to us is in Matthew 25. When did we see you hungry or thirsty and or naked or in prison? And then Jesus says, as you did it to the least of these, you did it to me, which is a teaching that the place where we meet Jesus is in the presence of neighbors who are destitute and who need interventions in their life by people who care for them in empowering and transformative ways. So those are two texts that we use all the time. But I think for the most part, when we read about Jesus, we do not understand that Jesus is enmeshed in huge systemic issues. It's not simply a matter of charity. It's not a matter of being nice or committing an occasional generous act. It is a systemic reorientation of our life outside of the greed system. And I have no doubt that eventually, the reason the Roman Empire had to execute him is not because he was a nice man or a Jewish teacher. It is because his teaching and his way of life represent a threat to the predatory system of Rome. We should not romanticize his death, but to see his death in the midst of a huge systemic crisis that he evoked.
Now, we're going to move on to Paul, but of course, first of all, the book of Acts talks about community amid empire. And then in Paul, you call it the life in the land of divine generosity. And this would, of course, include all of Paul's epistles.
Well, I was surprised when I started reading Paul, because I've been taught from the beginning that Paul is a champion of grace, but I had not been taught that God's gracious generosity pertains to economic matters. And I think I want to call attention particularly to two texts. The first one in 2 Corinthians 8, it's where Paul is conducting a collection for the poor church in Jerusalem, and he says about Jesus, though he was rich, for our sake he became poor, that by his becoming poor, he might make many rich. So that what Paul does is to base his request for money on his understanding of Christology, that Jesus is indeed the poor man who by his poverty empowered people to new life. The other text that seems so important to me, many texts do, in Galatians 5, Paul contrasts the fruits of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, generosity, with the power of desire. And under desire, evil desire, he puts fornication, quarrelsomeness, dissension, blasphemy, all kinds of destructive behavior. What dawned on me is that the single-minded pursuit of money in the practice of greed will produce a culture in which these evil desires become normative. And apropos of Jerry's enterprise of simple living, which wants to avoid acquisitiveness, makes time and energy for love, joy, peace, patience, generosity. So it occurred to me that in Galatians 5, these two lists of behavioral outcomes are outcomes of our attitudes toward money. And if you pay great attention to commercial television, much of the so-called entertainment is really a championing with mean-spirited sitcoms or so-called survival shows. They are exhibits of those kinds of destructive desires, and the practice of love, joy, peace, patience, generosity never gets airtime in the capitalist propaganda that pretty much controls public media. Reading those texts from Paul, and then I went on into 1 Timothy and James and so on, really show how the apostle is really urging the congregations to whom he writes to become aware that they are really marching to a different drummer about matters of money and possessions.
Yes, thank you. In chapter 13, you do talk about the pastoral epistles, Timothy's and Titus, and you call that order in the household. And then you go on to the Catholic epistles, to those of John and Peter and Hebrews. And then you focus on the letter of James, as you mentioned, which you call the deep either-or of practice. And so we'll conclude, as the Bible does, with the ultimate alternative, the book of Revelation, which, of course, too many people see as some big Hollywood production, but is actually about empire.
That's right. It is a document that apparently pertains to the early church when it was under persecution by the Roman Empire, and it is written to assure the early church that steadfast loyalty to Jesus in the long run is the truth that will prevail. And right in the middle of the book of Revelation, in chapters 16, 17, and 18, I think, there is a huge critique of Babylon, which in shorthand turns out to be the Roman Empire. So it's a critique of the Roman Empire with its greedy commercialization and mercantilism. And the point of the letter is that followers of Jesus are invited to a different way in the world. So they are said to be followers of the Lamb. And so Jesus is called the Lamb that was butchered for sacrifice. So Jesus is vulnerable, and he's quite unlike the military posturing of the Roman Empire, but the way the book of Revelation works is that by the time you get to the wonderful climax of chapters 21 and 22, the Lamb has prevailed, and in general, it is an argument that the Lamb, Jesus, and his way of being in the world finally will prevail over the aggressiveness of the empire. And so it's not, the book of Revelation is not voodoo, but it is really an incredible social analysis of systemic forces in conflict that has an amazing contemporaneity for us right now, because the power of empire, which is devoted to the concentration of wealth in the hands of the few to the suffering of the many, is a continuing operation in the world. And those who gather around Jesus are committed to a risky alternative, with the assurance given here that this risky alternative eventually will prevail.
I think the one comparison you draw is that the Bible is not so much about the hereafter, but about eventually a new heaven and new earth, or as it says in one place, a new city.
That's right. That's right. And which I translate into a new economy. Right.
I want to thank you so much. What you've been talking about in these two episodes is so relevant to voluntary simplicity. One of the mottos that we use is voluntary simplicity is not about deprivation. It is about abundance.
There's exactly.
There's enough for everybody's need, not anybody's greed.
It could not be said better than that, Jerry. Right.
Well, I look forward to talking to you again. I urge everyone to investigate Walter Brueggemann's new book, Money and Possessions, in the interpretation series from Westminster John Knox Press. And to start with would be to read the foreword, preface, and introduction online, and that link is in the show notes. My best wishes to you, and I'm looking forward to your next offering. Can you give us an idea of what that might be?
I'm just completing a little book on coerced silence in the Bible. I've only become aware of how many places in the Bible people tell other people to shut up, and I'm doing a series of texts on coerced silence, because I think coerced silence is a big deal in our society.
Thank you so much. Be well, my friend.
Good to talk to you, Jerry.
Indeed.
Have a good new year.
And you as well. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to one part of my conversation with renowned biblical scholar Walter Brueggemann, talking about his recent book, Money and Possessions. Be sure to listen to the other part, too. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com, on our Facebook page, or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click window number 3. Need a nudge? I've been producing today's Simpler Living Nudge for several months and welcome you to subscribe for free. Receive it by email or Twitter. Just send me an email with the subject nudge at simplelivingworks@yahoo.com. I've received lots of interesting responses, which you can read on simplelivingworks.org. Click on Recent Comments in window number 5, or see the link in the show notes. We've simplified our blogs for this year. The Weekly Nudge focuses only on the efforts of Simple Living Works. The Weekly Digest includes the latest posts from colleague organizations. Both come with a free subscription to our Simple Living Works blog. The much more complete, almost obsessively detailed monthly digest is now updated at least once a week and kept on the Simple Living Works site. Links to the monthly complete digest are given in both the Weekly Nudge and the Weekly Digest. We hope you'll check them out, but we don't want you to be overwhelmed by the amount of help available toward a life of simple living, which young adults now are inclined to call minimalism. As usual, I've lined up interesting thinkers and activists for this year for the podcast. It's time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to the podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want with or without show notes. Subscriptions to this podcast and to our weekly blog are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe in iTunes to my other podcast, The Common Good Podcast, which I produce and co-host with Jubilee One Earth Economics. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on our show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive way of life. It's not a list of rules, nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everybody's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, live simply that others may simply live, as our closing theme song proclaims. It's a balance of personal responsibility and advocacy for just public policy. It's more than personal happiness, though that's quite important. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the 5 life standards of Living More with Less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre. I've discussed these standards in the earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The 3 parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works Podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. Others can simply live, learn to live simply so others can simply live, learn to live simply so others can simply live, learn to live simply so others can live.